This is the Empowered Caregiver Show. If you are a caregiver or know someone who is, this show is meant to uplift you through education and support, while also lifting up every caregiver's invaluable role in society. Now, here is the Empowered Caregiver and your host, Liza Helen Brand.
You are listening to The Empowered Caregiver, and I am your host, Liza Hellenbrand. And if you listen to my show regularly, you will often hear me reference the fact that I have ADHD. I do this for a couple of reasons. First, it often impacts me in the moment. So instead of just dismissing it, I choose to address it. You know, ADHD is a part of me. It's a part of who I am. As long as I'm awake, it impacts me. It impacts my ability to function. It impacts my relationships, my work performance, my self-esteem, my mental health. I cannot think of one area of my life that is not affected or impacted by the fact that I have ADHD. So if I can call it out, if I can explain it, if I can raise awareness about how it impacts people like me, then I hope that information can help others. And if you have ADHD and you hear me talking about my struggles and you can relate, then hopefully you know you are not alone. So with that said, I am here today with Kelly Pickens from Undivided Attention, which is located here in Madison, Wisconsin. Kelly is an ADHD certified clinical service provider and a certified attention deficit consultant. She has also been a family nurse practitioner for over 20 years, and Kelly has ADHD diagnosis herself, so she has firsthand lived experience. Kelly works with men and women, and I'll talk to her more about that in a minute, but I think she has kind of a target of working with women. I know it impacts both, and I know that women can really struggle with the ADHD diagnosis and just the acceptance of that, and you know, it's the whole just difference between girls and boys, right? So we're going to dig into that a little bit. Because I think when a lot of people hear ADHD, their minds just go to the little disruptive boys that just can't sit still. However, it does. It really impacts men, women, young people, older people, the whole spectrum. So today we're going to learn more about ADHD and how it impacts all areas of people's lives. Because like I said, it is so much more than the inability to just pay attention or sit still. ADHD often is downplayed and can be the butt of a joke, which is hard and hurtful, but the reality of what we know, it's still fairly a new diagnosis. So with that said, it is a serious diagnosis. And when left untreated, it can have a negative impact across all domains of a person's life, including their education, their occupation, their social opportunities, relationships, finances, legal issues, even your overall general health and well-being. So with that said, let's jump right in. Kelly, thank you so much for joining me today. Mm-hmm. And before we get started talking about the ways ADHD impacts people and what we know can help, how do you define ADHD, or what exactly is it?
Right. Well, here's the elevator pitch. ADHD is an inherited neurodevelopmental disorder. There are subtle but impactful structural, chemical, and metabolic differences in the brains of people with ADHD, which affect how they think, feel, and act. And a nice way to define it is it's a pattern, present since childhood, but maybe not always impairing, of having an interest-driven nervous system with attentional dysregulation, the ability to hyperfocus.
Oh, yeah.
Difficulty with time management, emotional dysregulation, as you mentioned, impaired working memory, and subsequent to all of this is the rejection sensitivity. And most of this is not in the DSM. And, you know, what it really amounts to is executive dysfunction or impaired self-control, which is really a struggle to do the right things at the right time. And a lot of people really dislike the name and want to change it, because most people with ADHD neither have a deficit of attention, nor do they have overt physical hyperactivity. So here's my proposal for a new name. It's Disorder of Dysregulated Attention, Mood, Memory, and Time Management, a.k.a. Damn It.
Damn It. I love it. Damn it, I have it.
Apropos.
Yes, yes. I think we should go with that. Okay, when you started naming it all off, I'm like, I have ADHD. I lost you midway through that. But when you said, summed it up with, damn it, yes, that is what it is. Right. So you have on your website that you were diagnosed with ADHD at 48. Can you tell me a little bit about your personal journey and what led you to get the ADHD diagnosis?
Yeah, well, so it was January of 2020, and I needed to do some continuing education credits for my licensure, my NP license. And so I opened up the catalog in alphabetical order right at the top, adult ADHD. And I thought, I wonder what's new in adult ADHD. You know, I thought I knew about ADHD. But as I was going through this program, I learned two things. One, I knew pretty much nothing about ADHD, despite being a family nurse practitioner for 17 years at that point. And two, I had it. And this was absolutely shocking. ADHD was not on my radar. I had actually pursued neuropsych testing for, I thought maybe I had dementia a couple years prior to this. But nobody mentioned ADHD. But of course, you know, I didn't tell the neuropsychologist that, you know, I took the family car for a spin when I was 14 and that, you know, I was grounded most of my growing up and skipped most of my senior year in high school because I still got good grades, you know, like somehow, despite all of that, I was able to graduate high school with honors. But then things fell apart in college. There were cycles of like holding things together and then cycles of things falling completely apart, mostly feeling like I was holding my life together by a thread, but I really just thought I was a bad person. Mm. I never would have put ADHD into that.
I was going to ask you that, you know, how do you not know? How do you not see the struggles? But totally can relate. For me, it was college. Everything fell apart. I just didn't know if high school was much more small. I went to a small rural high school, a lot of hand holding, a lot of, you know,
a lot of structure.
A lot of structure. And I got to college and wow, the wheels fell off. Yes.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, to what you said, a lot of people, and I'm correct me if I'm wrong, specifically females just internalize it and think that they're just a bad, dumb, incapable, disorganized, whatever you want to call it, person.
Absolutely. Mm. And that presents as anxiety or depression.
Or both.
And so they're often misdiagnosed.
Yes, makes total sense. Let's talk statistics for a minute. It was very hard for me to find concrete numbers on the number of adults impacted by ADHD. This most likely has to do with the fact that the diagnosis wasn't really used before the 1980s. Now, we talked earlier that a lot of people just internalize these fault, you know, these ADHD characteristics in themselves, but the diagnosis itself really didn't come around to the 1980s. So you would think that 40 years would be plenty of time for the medical and teaching professions to get up to speed, but I feel like there is still so much around ADHD that we now know. However, it's not getting into the hands of the people that need it the most, including the medical and teaching professions, as well as parents. In October 23rd, 2023, an article in psychiatrist.com said, numerous studies have tried to quantify the prevalence of ADHD in adults, but because trials often use different methods and measures, it's been hard to pin down a consistent number. Estimates have ranged from as low as 2.5% to as high as 5% in the adult population. And when it comes to children, there are studies out there that show over 9% of youth under 18 have the diagnosis, with boys being diagnosed twice the rate of girls. I'm here today with Kelly Pickens, founder of Undivided Attention. Kelly, what are your thoughts about how we diagnose ADHD and what are some of the misconceptions?
Well, one thing is, you know, there's no one test to diagnose ADHD. And people have historically tried to use that as an argument that it doesn't exist. But, you know, there's no one test to diagnose irritable bowel syndrome or fibromyalgia or depression or even bipolar disorder. Like, these are clinical diagnoses, and there are many other examples of this in medicine. Now, there are clinicians out there who are using some of, like, the latest in technology, like functional MRIs or SPECT scans or qualitative EEGs. And it's possible that this could become the future of ADHD diagnosis, but right now we're not there in terms of, you know, the technology being affordable or reliable or accessible enough to really be implemented in most clinical settings. So for now, still, the best way is just a thorough interview with a knowledgeable clinician. And it is a misconception that neuropsychiatric testing is required to get the diagnosis. That's really only if you're also questioning if there's like a learning disability, maybe dyslexia present or something like that. But the reality is it's hard for adults to get diagnosed because, as you mentioned, clinicians just haven't received any training. And sadly, there's also a lot of implicit bias against ADHD and around neurodivergence in general. That's ableism. But really, it comes down to ignorance. You know, they don't know what they don't know.
Right.
And there are a lot of complex reasons for that, which that's a whole another episode. But suffice to say, it's not really their fault. I don't blame clinicians for their bias or lack of knowledge. Maybe the bias if they chose to ignore, you know, recent evidence and research, but they can only do that if they've been presented with information.
Sure.
And there are still no questions on the psychiatric board exam on adult ADHD.
Kind of unbelievable.
Yeah. And the kicker is, adult ADHD, untreated, reduces life expectancy by 12 to 20 years. That's
wow.
on par with diabetes.
That's a lot.
And, you know, we all, medicine and society as a whole, we take diabetes very seriously.
Right.
But we have been brushing ADHD off for decades. And we as a society are super failing people with ADHD.
Yeah, I am speaking with Kelly Pickens from Undivided Attention. When we come back, I want to ask Kelly what the process is for diagnosis and what you can do if you have a loved one that you think may have ADHD. Listening to The Empowered Caregiver, and I am your host, Liza Hellenbrand. Today, I'm here with Kelly Pickens from Undivided Attention. She is an ADHD specialist who works with men and women. And before the break, we discussed ADHD and the flaws in getting diagnosed, but I fell short of being able to ask Kelly about the diagnosis process. So if somebody gives you a call, what are the steps? Can you walk me through what you do at your clinic, Undivided Attention?
Yeah. So what I do is when someone requests a book an appointment with me, which they can do directly from my website, that triggers a process where I send to them numerous forms, surveys, questionnaires, and computerized cognitive tests for them to complete, which is not necessarily very ADHD friendly, unfortunately.
you said it, not me. I was just thinking it.
but it's a lot of work up front on their part. But what that does for me is it frees up my time for them. So before they come to see me, I have most of my questions answered.
Nice.
And that allows more of them to be asking questions.
Right.
And we can just then really spend a lot more time diving deeper down into what ADHD really is, and which is critical for, you know, how you move forward with your ADHD.
Yeah. And I think doing that homework at home for most people that have ADHD or feel like they have ADHD, it's very interesting because that's when it's like, oh yeah, yep, yep, oh yes.
And exactly.
So the light bulb really goes on. So it can be just kind of, what's the word that I'm looking for?
Validating.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to know that ADHD impacts attention and that it can create hyperactivity because that's in the name. To me, as someone who struggles with ADHD, it is so much more than that. I really want to spend a good chunk of our time talking about the other areas in your life that are impacted when you have ADHD. I have with me today ADHD specialist and founder of Undivided Attention, Kelly Pickens. Kelly, you have on your website that ADHD impacts your nervous system and memory. It impairs your reward and pleasure pathways and creates time blindness and can cause rejection sensitivity and emotional dysregulation. So those are a lot of big words and big terms and a lot to talk about with each and every one of them. So let's dig in. Can you tell me more about the nervous system and ADHD?
The soundbite of how one of the most complex disorders affects one of the most complex phenomena in the known world, the human nervous system. I think it helps to utilize the power of metaphors. So here's one many people have heard. Ferrari brain with bicycle brakes, driving down a winding mountain road, okay?
Yep.
The ADHD nervous system is always going, always reacting, can't filter out, what isn't important, irrelevant information, struggle to direct their behavior towards the things that are important over things that are interesting. And this comes mainly from dysregulation of dopamine and norepinephrine, which are two neurotransmitters implicated in ADHD. And the areas of the brain affected is pretty much everything except for the occipital region, which is responsible for visual processing. But really, it's so complex. It affects every region of the brain and how specifically they communicate with one another. And the consequences of all of this is, having an interest-driven nervous system and not being able to put the brakes on your thoughts, your feelings, and sensations. And all of this, varies. Like the consequences of all of that is going to be situational. But one thing that doesn't vary is the shame associated with every dropped ball, every missed appointment, every, bad test grade. And that shame compounds for several reasons. One is that you know better. It's not a problem of, knowing what to do.
Right.
You know how to do homework. You know how to read a clock and tell what time it is. And, you know how to do these things. It's a problem of making your body do it. And that's very confusing to everyone. And so people try to hide their struggles to do what they know, to do these things that are important, but boring, repetitive, mundane, require multiple steps and complex preparation and organization.
That makes so much sense. One final thought on the nervous system, and I just want to make sure I'm understanding this, and I don't want to open a whole new can of worms, because like I said, each one of these topics, we could do a whole show on how ADHD impacts an individual. But before the show started, I just shared a little bit how I am really getting to this realization that I am always stuck in fight or flight. And I just can't even relax or let loose the slightest. I mean, I can, but it's always there.
Right.
Is that ADHD? Yeah.
Absolutely. So, when you have an interest-driven nervous system, but the majority of the things that you have to do in life are uninteresting, you have to tap into basically brute force and anxiety to accomplish most of the things in your life. Mm. Right. And this is exhausting. It's leads to burnout, exhaustion, meltdowns, and rejection sensitivity because you're always in a cycle of being, your brain is leading you towards these things that are interesting and you're leaving behind all of the important things. And so you're always playing catch up and you're just receiving a lot more negative feedback about the things that you didn't do that you should have done. And you beat yourself up because you didn't do them and you think you should be able to, but it doesn't make sense. You don't know how to ask for help, to do the things you know how to do. And this is what I call the ADHD stress cycle. This chronic stress of not being able to do important things that you know how to do.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. And you know, I do. And then we'll talk about, you know, procrastination a little bit later on, because that definitely plays into it.
It'll come right back to this.
Yes. It's like the fire alarm is always going off inside me, and I kind of need that to get things done.
Yeah, and because there's no dopamine to do it.
Yes. And I often am just exhausted because it's physically tiring to be, I mean, when you actually hear a fire alarm go off, you know, and then everyone's a little panic, even just, you know, practice, whatever, and it's all ended, it wipes you out. It can.
Yeah.
And that is just about every day of my life. And I know that I am not alone in this. So when working with you, how do you address this in your treatment?
Well, first, people with ADHD really need to deeply understand what it is and what it means for them. And once you really understand what it means to have an interest-driven nervous system, you can start to interrupt that stress cycle. You know, disability occurs when demands outweigh an individual's resources. Like, that is stress. So we start the process of flipping that equation. We increase resources and work to reduce demands. And the first thing we're looking to for increasing resources really is medications. Stimulant medications are first-line treatment for anyone with ADHD over age 6. They get dopamine and norepinephrine to the areas of the brain needed for motivation, attention, alertness, arousal, and they strengthen the brakes.
Wonderful. I need to talk to you more about that. When we come back, we are going to pick up where we left off. We're going to talk more about working memory, time blindness, the different aspects of ADHD, not only what they are so you have that level of awareness, but what we can do about it. Listening to The Empowered Caregiver, and I am your host, Liza Hellenbrand. Today I am here with Kelly Pickens from Undivided Attention. And Kelly, I am going to try my hardest to rein my own ADHD in so I can get through these questions and not get off track, because they are so important. Now, we are talking about different ways that ADHD can impact an individual. And the next question on my list is working memory. What does that mean? And where do we see this being impacted or impacting children and adults?
Yeah, so I like to call ADHD dementia light.
Oh, yes.
it's a joke, but in all seriousness, the memory impairments are hugely impactful. And working memory is the ability to hold on to information while you're doing something else. So let's say you're doing the dishes, and in the middle of doing dishes, you remember that you need to pull out a pork tenderloin from the freezer for tomorrow's dinner, but your hands are covered in dish suds, and then the phone rings, and it's your mother, so you take the call, and also the dog needs to go outside, and after letting the dog outside, you see you forgot to switch the laundry. You forget that you were even doing dishes, so those are unfinished.
Like, I feel like you've been spying on me.
And that tenderloin literally no longer exists until tomorrow when you're driving home from work and you start to think about dinner. But, you know, so that's what it looks like in adults, right? And in kids, it might look like forgetting to complete all the steps of a task. For instance, like if you ask your child to take out the garbage and they've done it numerous times before, but they repeatedly forget to put a new garbage bag back in the can. It doesn't matter how many times you remind them to do it. If you are not reminding them right then, at the moment, at the point of performance, they will not remember. They will forget. And these things, you know, everyone can be forgetful from time to time, right? The difference in ADHD is the frequency with which this occurs and the negative impact that it has on the individual and the people around them. So out of sight, out of mind applies to everything in a person in ADHD's life, including people.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that?
Well, so that's one of the reasons why a lot of people with ADHD have difficulty maintaining relationships. It's because, you know, really, people with ADHD are going to be focused on whatever is in their immediate visual field. Mm-hmm. And when people aren't there, they're not thinking about that person necessarily. So, you know, they may forget to call, forget to reach out and maintain relationships. And the other person may think that, you know, you're doing that intentionally, but it's never intentional. It's just, if I don't see you, I can't think about you.
Yes. I'm so glad that you said that, because I have a daughter that lives in LA and she's breaking my heart, never reaching out to mom, and she has ADHD. And so, yeah, that makes perfect sense. So what are some tips or tricks for people with poor working memory?
Yeah. Find an image of a hazard sign, print out multiple copies, and post them all around your house, your car, your purse, your wallet, your backpack, with the warning that says, do not trust your memory, ever. And make all of your memory as external as possible. Post-it notes, voicemail message, text yourself, email yourself, use the notes, the calendar, the reminder apps in your phone. Keep dry erase markers or like bath crayons in your shower.
Ah, oh, that's a great idea. I'm not sure I'll remember that, but that's a great idea. Okay, I will have to try harder. I'm assuming that this is a skill that takes some time to develop and learn, because I'm going to tell you, I have tried some of those tricks. And then it's like, I need a reminder to remind me that I set a reminder, you know, the string around your finger to remember.
Absolutely.
The, yeah.
Remembering to remember, and then remembering where you wrote it down. I mean, these are things, like, this is why I say it's dementia light.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. You also mentioned time blindness on your website. What is that, and how does that show up in ADHD?
In a couple ways. Well, number one is our perception of, you know, how long tasks will take is really unreliable. So any task that has a negative emotion associated with it, we will perceive that to take so much longer than it does in reality. And the opposite is true for tasks that are interesting, fun, immediately rewarding, etc. So, you know, the other part is that people with ADHD have a hard time holding the future in mind. You know, their own future. So there's a saying in ADHD land, now or not now. Everything is now or not now. There is no later.
Ah.
You know, we often think, well, I don't want to do that right now. This is going to take forever. I just don't have time to do that right now. I'm going to do that later. But later never comes.
Later never
there's only
comes.
Now.
You're right.
Or not now.
You're so right. Oh, Kelly. Okay, so you have on your website that ADHD impairs your reward and pleasure pathways. Now, this one I feel like I'm not as familiar as some of the other areas. Can you tell me more about that?
So dopamine is the neurotransmitter involved in reward prediction and motivation. It's also the signal to your motor cortex that makes your body do a thing that will result in a reward. So without dopamine in the right areas of the brain, you really can't sense a reward, and then there's just no doing of the thing. There's no willpower. Dopamine is motivation. It's willpower. It's doing, right? And a decent analogy here is like your car's idle. If your car is idling too low, it's more likely to stall out. You know, so you have to give it more gas more quickly, especially if you're stopped on an incline, to prevent it from stalling out. So ADHD brains can stall out. Any rewards that are too far in the future are not going to trigger motivation for the ADHDer. And that's kind of true of negative consequences as well. But dopamine also plays a role in our sense of wellness and contentedness. And that's something called hedonic tone. ADHDers may have a low hedonic tone. And there can be kind of like this baseline mental state of just like, meh.
Meh. Yeah.
You know, it's something between, you know, boredom and frank depression, unless you're in hyperfocus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like there's just, it's hard to find that baseline, right? Is it common to go from up to down to here to there?
Absolutely. Yes. Yep. So, yeah, I mean, we also, you know, so we are our hedonic tone, or our like pulse for what is going to make us feel like things are okay, everything's okay, we're good, we feel fine. You know, the input needed to get there is much higher than that for a neurotypical person. A neurotypical person kind of hovers around like, yeah, things are good. Everything's fine. Mm. I don't need anything more than what is happening right now. But people with ADHD can often feel like, I need something more.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's hard. You almost kind of just have to make that sound because there's not words for it, but that right. exactly sums it up beautifully in my mind anyways. So when you're talking about dopamine, there was one little side thought going off and I'm just curious about social media and, you know, how that plays in, because I hear that people go there for a dopamine hit. What does that look like in ADHD?
Well, that's definitely a loaded question. And that yeah. for sure is an episode all in of itself. People with ADHD probably are among the group of people who have a lot of negative impacts from spending time on social media, because yeah. that's not true for everyone. You know, yeah. some people can feel good using social media, but a lot of people who maybe already have maybe a little bit of a lower self-esteem,
right?
You know, going to social media is going to amplify that.
Sure.
And also, you know, if you don't do things with intention, you can lose time very easily. And often mm-hmm. when we go to like social media, it's different than like, okay, I'm going to watch one episode of The Golden Girls right now, right? Like the episode's over, you know, 20 sure. minutes go by. You go to social media, there's no time, like you're yeah. just, there's no end.
Yeah.
So yeah, time disappears.
I had to throw out social media because I feel like it's really made my ADHD worse. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that makes sense, but it's impacting me in not a good way.
In some ways it's mixed, right? Because social media also can put into words and put into pictures what we can't just like verbalize and contextualize about our symptoms. You know, that's one thing about memes that have been so wonderful is like, they're so relatable.
Yes, definitely. And, you know, I love to learn. I love to seek out information. And when you get a phone or a computer in front of you, I mean, it's endless.
Right.
You could spend the rest of your life there taking in. And so, we definitely mm-hmm. could do a whole show on that. Mm-hmm. There is another thing that I want to talk about. There is a term called rejection dysphoria. Can you explain that and how it impacts those with ADHD? And if you have any tips on what to do.
Yeah. So when any of us gets called out for some sort of like misstep, mistake, or like other transgression, this triggers a trauma response in the autonomic nervous system, right? The autonomic nervous system functions to keep us alive. So let's say 2-year-old Jimmy is about to put a fork in the light socket and mom yells from across the room, "Jimmy, no!" That's scary, right? It shocks us. It grabs our attention and it triggers that response, and that's fight, flight, or freeze. But there's a secondary response, and that response is shame. And it's the sense of being really conspicuous and judged and that you messed up. So the first is gasp, and then the tears of shame, you know, fall, right? And shame is important. It's present in all mammals because it's how we learn. It's very motivating for us to change and grow and get along with others. We don't want to keep messing up. We don't want to be kicked out of the group. We're a social species. We depend on each other for our survival. And we want to survive, right? In ADHD, though, we are getting called out for mistakes, mishaps, whatever. We receive negative feedback on an order of magnitude more often than our neurotypical peers. So kids with ADHD receive 20,000 more negative feedback messages by the time they are age 10. Mm. And, you know, there is a ratio of what is healthy that will create healthy self-esteem, and it's 5 positive to 1 negative.
Wow.
So ADHDers are...
yes.
Yeah.
Live in shame.
Live in shame, yeah. And so, you know, So we're getting all these negative feedback messages, and this can lead to rejection sensitivity, where even the perception that someone is being critical of you can trigger a very big fight, flight, freeze, and shame reaction. And that, for some people, can turn into rejection sensitivity dysphoria. And dysphoria means unbearable pain. Mm. It's the feeling of, you know, you get called out. It triggers this sense of, you know, being punched in the gut. And it can ruin the day, the week, or longer in RSD, rejection sensitive dysphoria. It's like a form of PTSD.
Yes, I would say longer. I remember in first grade, a student next to me dropped their box of crayons, and I looked down and was watching them pick them up. I can't remember if it was a male or female, some kid. And the teacher said, "Well, just don't stand there. Help." And just the shame. And I'm going to be 50, and I can recall that like it was yesterday. Just
right.
And so, how do you deal with that? How do you let that go? Because it is so real, and it just breaks my heart when I see these parents yell at these kids.
Right.
Yes.
Well, first of all, if you are a parent who has a child with ADHD, you must stop yelling immediately. But if you are a person with ADHD and RSD. You know, the therapies, the interventions that treat PTSD, that re-regulate the autonomic, you know, nervous system, that increase the tone of the rest and digest system, not the fight or flight system. All of these approaches, these somatic exercises and EMDR and, trauma approaches
sure.
can help re-regulate the nervous system. It's a lot of letting go of should. Mm-hmm. I should be able to do this. And then there are also medications that can help. There's a category of medications to treat ADHD called alpha-2 agonists, and they seem to tone down the fight or flight response and help us just focus on what's important and not irrelevant thoughts, feelings, and sensations.
I love that. And that's kind of where I'm at on my ADHD journey right now. I am exploring EMDR and just how to get rid of just decades of shame and pain that live in your body. They don't,
right.
It doesn't go away after the instance happened. So remember right. that, parents.
Yes.
When we come back, we are going to talk about another big topic, emotional dysregulation. Listening to The Empowered Caregiver, and I am your host, Liza Hellenbrand. Today, I am here with Kelly Pickens from Undivided Attention. Kelly is an ADHD certified clinical service provider and a certified attention deficit consultant. She has also been a family nurse practitioner for over 20 years, and she has ADHD herself, so she has firsthand experience. Today, we are talking everything ADHD. We covered a lot of ground. If you missed it, you can find the replay of today's show on civicmedia.us. We are on Spotify, YouTube, and Apple Podcasts. So I highly recommend that you check it out and share it with loved ones that you know that have ADHD or you think that they may. There's tons of useful information and conversations going on here today. And on that note, I want to jump back in. So before break, I had mentioned emotional dysregulation. What is that and how is that impacted with ADHD?
Yeah, so emotional dysregulation in ADHD can take many forms. And one of them we just talked about is rejection sensitivity. We talked about low hedonic tone. And there's also the opposite of rejection sensitivity dysphoria, which is praise sensitive euphoria. The thing is, dopamine is associated with a sense of wellness and reward, right? So when we do find a hyper-focus that is triggering a lot of dopamine, we can get very excited. You know, the emotions that people with ADHD feel and express are appropriate to the trigger or situation. They are just more intense than what others expect or what might be considered socially appropriate. We feel things more deeply and express them more vividly. Period.
Period. Enough said. Drop the mic. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And my ADHD mind was going a million miles per hour. So now I got to pull it back to where we're at. Tell me a little bit more about the emotional dysregulation. How does that show up? Can you give an example?
Well, let's say, for instance, you know, you finally had, like, you've been in between hyperfocuses for a while and you've just kind of been in the meh stage. Mm-hmm. But then you discover a new hobby and you're so excited about it. All you want to do is talk to everyone about it. And so, you know, you're very exuberant about it. You overshare. It's a lot of that. People may say that, like, you're too much.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you get shushed in libraries or at dinner because you start talking about something you're excited about, your volume goes up.
Yep.
As you get more excited,
you start talking faster.
You start talking faster, all these things, right? Yes. So that's, you know, one way that it can show up.
And what's if you're finding yourself in that situation and you're reading the room and you're like, uh-oh, mm-hmm. I'm a little bit too much right now. I can sense it. How do we take it down a notch?
Right. Deep breaths. You know, I mean, mindfulness practices are really helpful for ADHD and, you know, learning what is happening in your ADHD and then realizing, like, oh, this is ADHD. This isn't me being a bad person or, like, you know, too much or too loud. This is ADHD. And now I recognize it and I can take a deep breath and just pause. Like, we have to start learning how to build in a pause, right? We have to strengthen the breaks.
I like that. And, you know, one thing that I think I would add from my personal experience, and if you disagree, you can say that you disagree, is also raising your level of curiosity and awareness. I mean,
yeah,
especially even when it goes to meditation. Okay, meditation and ADHD don't go hand in hand, right? But if you start getting curious,
right,
what are these thoughts?
Yeah.
What are these feelings?
Exactly.
Where are they coming from?
Yeah.
What are they trying to tell me?
Right. And that is mindfulness.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I just want people to know that it's a misconception that mindfulness and meditation, I think, is sitting there thinking of of nothing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's not it. And it's been extremely helpful for me personally. So today, it seems more common than not to receive multiple mental health conditions and diagnosis. In fact, research shows that more than half of people who receive one psychiatric disorder diagnosis will receive a second or a third within their lifetime, and about a third will receive four or more. So I'm talking about four or more DSM-5 mental diagnosis. Kelly, can you expand on that? And is there anything you would want listeners to know about, I cannot say this word,
comorbidities.
Thank
right.
you. And ADHD.
Yeah. Look, I mean, how we, you know, science and Western medicine have approached quote unquote mental health has been so siloed and rigid. You know, we've historically not done a good job considering how dimensional a person is within the context of their genetics, their environment, their experiences, particularly during development. And just as you say, ADHD is accompanied by these other psychiatric disorders, the opposite is also true. At least 40% of clients who present to a mental health service, you know, for services, will also have ADHD. And so mental health providers really need to have much more, you know, a much higher index of suspicion for ADHD and not be surprised that they are seeing a lot of ADHD because, look, it's common. You mentioned the statistics earlier.
Yeah.
The DSM-5 reports 6 to 10% of children globally, with another 5% being very, very close to meeting that criteria. So close to 15% of the world. And we used to think 2/3 of people outgrew ADHD. I mean, we used to think everybody outgrew it. And then we thought, well, maybe 2/3 outgrow it. But as of 2021, there was a study that was published in the University of Washington School of Medicine. And it turns out actually only about 10% of people outgrow their ADHD. So adult ADHD is common. It's probably the most common, quote unquote, mental disorder there is. And 70% of the adults out there who have it have not yet been diagnosed.
That makes a lot of sense. And when I was when I originally read the 2.5% of adults, I'm thinking, no way.
Right. That's way under. Yeah.
Yes. I'm speaking today with Kelly Pickens from Undivided Attention. Kelly is an ADHD certified clinical service provider and certified attention deficit disorder. I almost said consultant. That's a mouthful. So ADHD expert, let's just leave it like that.
Perfect.
Kelly, can you just end by letting people know where they can find you and what are some of the services and approaches that you take?
I think the best place to start is my website, and that's www.uaadhd.com. And you know, the first thing that I do for all of my clients is provide validation, period.
What a great place to start.
It's the most important thing.
I wish we had more time. We were doing so good on all the questions I prepared, and I tried my hardest to stay on track, but we will absolutely have to talk again. There is so much to learn and know and share when it comes to ADHD. Thank you so much, Kelly, for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.